secret for 100 years. It's a family story that even the family didn't know.
100 years ago, women were not very familiar with their bodies and what was expected. So if he said, put your feet up, you know, she wouldn't know what was in the syringe. They had no idea that 100 years later, people would be doing DNA testing and piecing all this together. These were family secrets.
This is part two of our story of Montreal's black market baby scandal. If you have not heard part one, I strongly suggest listening to that now. It's waiting for you on your feed. Have a listen. The title of part one is Black Market Babies. For those of you who heard part one when we first aired it last month, you might need a quick reminder. Here it is. Black Market Babies is the story, an underworld story, of an international baby smuggling ring in which hundreds of newborns were bought and sold out of Montreal in the 1950s. This resulted in international investigations, police raids, criminal trials. At its heart, this story of babies for sale is a story about families. And in this episode, it is told by the families. As you'll hear, both of our reporters today have personal family connections to the story that they're about to bring you. Like, very personal. One of our reporters' own mother was bought and sold. And our other reporter, their DNA tied her to one of the alleged masterminds behind the black market baby trade. So, here it is. Today, the shocking conclusion to Black Market Babies. Wait for it.
I want to tell you a story about my great-grandfather. His name was Leon. Leon Azoulay. Dr. Leon Azoulay.
Dr. Azoulay, will you tell the court what happened on August 20th, 1947?
I was away from my office on a trip.
And the place where I'm going to start my story is the moment where Leon is about to take the stand in his own defense.
When I returned at around 1 p.m., the patient,
Blanche Lepire of Beaupré, Quebec,
was in my waiting room.
The charge is murder. My great-grandfather Leon is a short, middle-aged man. Balding, his glasses round and clunky, and the fedora clutched in his left hand mark him as a middle-class man of the 1950s. Not the kind of guy you'd notice entering a room. Not even a courtroom. In fact, the reporters covering the two-week trial find him so nondescript, they pretty much fail to describe him at all. Even when he's at the center of a murder trial. The courtroom press are far more taken with the sideshow. The Montreal Star wrote, "Again today, as in the past 2 days, the Court of King's Bench here resembled a medical lecture room, as doctor witnesses brandishing shiny surgical instruments and anatomical illustrations explained to judge and jury how and why Mrs. Blanche Lepire, 40-year-old widow, could have met her death." Leon's murder trial was covered extensively by the local papers. The dialogue in this episode is taken from direct quotes he made on the stand, statements he made to police, court stenographer readings of his testimony, and reporter summaries of what he said at his trials.
"She did not seem seriously ill, so I asked if I could go have a shave. I returned around 2:15 and found her complaining of stomach pains. Gave her a quick examination, but before I could begin a more thorough investigation, she suffered a hemorrhage and fell off the table. 15 minutes later, she was dead."
I didn't have a normal childhood because, you know, for 10 years, we always had the aggravation of the trials or my mother crying while she's typing.
That's Harold Azoulay, Leon's son.
Because we couldn't afford typists, my mother would always be typing up appeals to the Quebec Board of Appeals or the Supreme Court of Canada, and she'd be typing there dead in the middle of the night, crying her eyes out while doing it. I remember these massive binders, you know, yellow pages. I don't know why that sticks with me, but they were definitely yellow pages.
What did you do after she hemorrhaged?
I raced around my office. I was everywhere at the same time. I had to stop the bleeding. She would be dead in 5 minutes. I was very anxious to save her life for her sake as well as for mine.
My father was frantic. He couldn't stop the bleeding. Now, she had fibroids, and he was using any instrument in his power to try and stop the bleeding. So he had to also take pregnancy instruments.
Fibroids are benign tumors that usually develop within the wall of a woman's uterus. And given the nature of fibroids, it would make sense that an examination would include the use of gynecological instruments related to pregnancy and abortions. During the trial, a policewoman described what she saw when she reached the crime scene.
I went into Dr. Azoulay's office and found the woman lying in a pool of blood in a side room. Her body was clad in a scanty garment, and the clothes were hung up nearby.
Harold is in his 80s now, but he remembers the father of his childhood the way many of us do, as a larger-than-life figure. Not only did his father speak 7 languages, English, French, Turkish, Arabic, Hebrew, Yiddish, and something called Ladino.
One of the languages he spoke was Ladino, which is the 15th century Spanish.
That's Yael, Leon's granddaughter.
And so he would invite the Spanish consul over and they would talk in Ladino. And the Spanish consul would find it really funny because it's like going to someone and speaking like Elizabethan English.
Leon also roared around Montreal on a motorcycle.
My father had decided to get married to my mother in Montreal. A week before the wedding, he decided to use his motorcycle and drive all the way to Montreal. I mean, she says, I'm his first love, but the motorcycle was the second love.
This love of motorcycles made Leon, at least in Harold's childhood eyes, the only doctor in town who did house calls in a leather jacket and motorcycle helmet. But that rebellious streak in his dad also tipped into risk-taking.
My father had a bad gambling problem, very bad. He loved it, you know. Yeah, sometimes he would make big and sometimes he would lose big. My mother said at that time, if you don't put us in the poorhouse, I don't care. Have fun. My mother, for some crazy reason, even with all my father's shenanigans, loved him. Like anything, you know. She said, I could not imagine living in this world without him.
After a 2-week trial, it only took 20 minutes of deliberation for the jury to reach their verdict. Guilty. Azoulay was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 7 years. The court judged that Lapeer had died while Leon was attempting to provide an illegal abortion. This amounted to manslaughter. According to newspaper reports at the time, apart from a slight flush, he took the news calmly. His wife burst into tears. The end of Leon's trial is just the start of our story.
To pack up and depart.
So like the challah is already made, the salad is already made, the vegetables
are all set up.
The vegetables are all cut. So really like an hour before we eat, I'm going to throw stuff in the oven.
Perfect.
But really there's no prep left to do.
I'm in Montreal having dinner with Yael and Harold, and we're sharing family stories. You know, one of those family gatherings you have where an awkward subject comes up.
This was before the days of artificial insemination, so whether he used a cup and a syringe or another way. And I know that sounds weird, but even now in the 21st century, there are women of a certain age who really don't know their body parts, really don't understand their anatomy at all. So I would imagine 100 years ago, women were not very familiar with their bodies and what was expected. So if he said, put your feet up. You know, she wouldn't know what was in the syringe. They had no idea that 100 years later people would be doing DNA testing and piecing all this together. These were family secrets.
Family secrets. We've all got them. And this family secret is the one that hooked me on the story of Leon Azoulay. It wasn't the murder trial. That was on the public record. No. The family secret that dragged me down all these rabbit holes is further back. If we were in the Marvel Universe, what I'm about to tell you would be Leon's origin story. I've recruited Adam Siegel to help tell it. If you heard the first episode of this story, you already know Adam. But if you haven't, the brief bio is Adam Siegel, Toronto journalist, who has been covering Montreal's black market baby scandal for almost a decade. Okay, Adam picks up the story.
Let me set the scene. In true Marvel origin story fashion, a meteor streaks through the prairie sky, crashing into a field outside a small town in southern Manitoba. True story. It's the second largest meteorite of its kind to ever strike Canadian soil. And that meteorite is the claim to fame of a place called Elm Creek, Manitoba. In that town, there's a young doctor. His name, you probably guessed, is Leon Azoulay. This is 3 decades before his murder trial in Montreal. So the town has a local meteorite and a doctor, but what it doesn't have is a synagogue. So every now and then, Leon makes the one-hour trip to Winnipeg. There, he meets a married couple, Sam and Jenny. For 12 years, they've been trying to have a baby. Shortly after meeting Leon, miraculously, they do have a baby. And then another, and then another.
Suddenly having 3 kids after 12 years of trying? Maybe no more miraculous than a huge meteorite landing just outside a small prairie town. I mean, stranger things happen all the time. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. Because Sam and Jenny are my great-grandparents. Yep, family secrets. A decade ago, I joined 23andMe. And you can probably guess, a whole new family tree sprouts. And I find out my great-grandfather isn't actually my great-grandfather. Well, not biologically. The DNA reveals my actual biological great-grandfather is Leon Azoulay, the doctor who befriended Sam and Jenny 100 years ago. I put the next obvious question to Elle.
Was there any chance it was an affair?
I doubt it. I think Sam and Jenny had a very strong marriage, from what I understand from their kids.
Yael and Harold are my blood relatives, but this is the first time I've met them. They're part of the 23andMe revelation. In trying to puzzle out Leon and my great-grandparents, we think Leon traveled from Elm Creek to the nearest synagogue, which was in Winnipeg. And there, he met Sam and Jenny. They became friends, and 23andMe revealed that all 3 of Sam and Jenny's kids were biologically Leon's children. So, okay, if it was an affair, maybe 1 kid would make sense. But 3?
I know everybody says my grandfather and grandmother were so in love. And I mean, certainly in looking at the DNA 23andMe, it's not like we have so many extra cousins. It's not like he was doing this to many women. It looks like it was really just this one couple that he had befriended.
So now, when we hear that earlier clip again,
whether he used a cup and a syringe or another way, even now in the 21st century, there are women of a certain age who really don't know their body parts. So if he said, put your feet up, you know, she wouldn't know what was in the syringe. They had no idea that 100 years later, people would be doing DNA testing and piecing all this together. These were family secrets.
Nobody knows what happened when Sam and Jenny met Leon once upon a time. What I do know is that this motorcycle riding gambler, this DIY artificial inseminator, this loving father and husband, this Ladino-speaking polyglot, this doctor convicted of manslaughter, collected one more title, Doctor on Call, for one of Montreal's notorious baby farms.
I think they call him King of Babyland.
Allegedly the center of a multi-million dollar, multinational baby smuggling ring.
As long as we have people and greed and money, we will always have some crime. But as long as we stay on top of it, we can keep it at a minimum.
We laid out the details of the black market baby scandal in our last episode. How the black market sourced babies.
Here's something that not many people know about the baby business. There are leg men. We call them leg men, though some of them are women, who make it their business to find pregnant women who are not married.
We met some of the smugglers.
My job is to smuggle black market babies out of Canada and into the United States. Yeah, I've been at it off and on the past 5 years. Maybe there's an easier way to make a bankroll, but I don't know it.
In our first episode, we told you how that underworld worked. Now, we need to take a look at the larger world the black market thrived in. Was Leon really at the heart of that underworld?
This is a massive church.
Gorgeous.
Now we're standing outside St. John Baptiste Church in Montreal's Plateau neighborhood.
Look at the columns. They've got to
really
be 20 feet
statues,
high.
Statues. Arches.
It's hard to understate how small we are at street level when you're looking up towards this. I mean, this must have been the most dominant building in the neighborhood 125 years ago.
So this is a Catholic church, which means that probably if those women hadn't had those babies in Sarah Wyman's home, they would have been coming to someplace like this to surrender them. And then those babies would have presumably ended up as orphans in the Duplessis system.
In the 1950s, when the black market baby ring was at its height, Maurice Duplessis was in the middle of a 15-year run as Quebec's premier. This would later become known as Le Grand Noirceur, or the Great Darkness.
Imaginez-vous, Duplessis, ce dictateur.
Some of our opponents must be surprised. Imagine, Duplessis, that dictator, calls an election a year before he has to. Dictators aren't in the habit of calling elections, certainly not a year before it's necessary.
And during the Great Darkness, Duplessis' orphans were born.
The province had few social services and a powerful Catholic church.
What happened to Quebec's orphans in the 1940s and 50s under Duplessis' rule would become the biggest child abuse case in Canadian history, outside of the residential school scandal. Quebec's orphan system would sweep up thousands of children, but the provincial government was especially keen on one particular class of orphans. You see, for every orphan the province took in, the feds gave them $1.25 in subsidies. But for every psychiatric patient the province took care of, the feds shelled out $2.75.
Basically, if the province declared an orphan to be mentally unwell, the province would get twice as much money.
In one case alone, hundreds of children were institutionalized overnight when their orphanage was declared an asylum. A commission in the early 1960s found that 7,000 people were falsely declared to be psychiatric patients.
This is on top of other sadly familiar charges of systemic sexual and physical abuse of the orphans.
So, an unwed Montreal mother in the 1950s who did not want to or could not keep her baby, had the following choice. Either surrender her baby to the black market or to the Great Darkness. But there's one more piece of the puzzle.
So we're standing at 4351 Avenue L'Esplanade. In Montreal's Plateau, we're just below Parc Jean-Mons. There's people playing tennis, barbecuing, enjoying a Saturday afternoon. This is formerly a B&B called Casa Bianca, and as I can see, and Alana, you can see, it's a completely white brick house. Why are we here? Because my mom in the 1940s was born in this exact building and sold to childless Jewish parents from Edmonton. My grandmother and grandfather came out here on the train in late 1945 and awaited a phone call. They paid $10,000 for her, and by the end of January, she had a birth certificate that named her adoptive parents as her parents.
If you're really going to get the full picture of what adoption was like during de Plessis' years, there's one more piece of the puzzle. It was called religious matching. Premier de Plessis was a devout Catholic, and his provincial government enforced a policy known as religious matching. Any unwanted babies born to a specific faith had to be adopted into families that practiced that same faith. Catholic babies must be adopted by Catholic families. Jewish babies must be adopted by Jewish families. There was just one problem. There were a lot of unwanted Catholic babies and not a lot of unwanted Jewish babies.
In 1951, 400 Jewish couples reported adopting children in Quebec. Yet police claimed that only 4 illegitimate births were reported by Jewish women. The law won't let Jewish people adopt children from Catholic mothers. So where were the 400 babies adopted by Jewish families coming from?
Of course, they told my parents that I was Jewish. They promised.
That's Francine George. We met Francine in episode 1. And just like my mother, she was sold on the black market.
I was never told I was adopted. I believed I was born to my mother in Plainfield, New Jersey. I found a picture of my mother, my adoptive mother, on a beach, and the photo was dated September 5th, 1951. She was in a bathing suit. So I asked her, "Why aren't you pregnant?"
English and French newspapers estimate that thousands of Catholic children were trafficked out of Montreal and sold to gullible or naive Jewish parents.
My mother used to say, "They promised us you were Jewish. You're Jewish. I know you're Jewish because that lady told us you were Jewish." And my father used to go, "Who cares?"
So that's the world Leon lived in. The pressures of church and state filling orphanages. But adoption made difficult by religious matching laws. The rise of a lucrative baby smuggling network across Canada and down into the U.S. And eventually, the court and newspapers placed Leon at the heart of that smuggling ring. But why? In 1952, Leon had been convicted of manslaughter and was out on bail and appealing the conviction when the press accused him of being at the heart of the baby smuggling ring. Basically, he was alleged to be delivering babies in illegal maternity homes, or what the press called baby farms.
From what I heard from my mother, he was just doing a good deed.
Leon's son Harold remembers that good deed and what it led to.
This young teenage girl was destitute and she was going to give birth, and she couldn't afford it. She didn't know what to do. This lawyer had approached my father and said, "If you ever come across a case of somebody who needs to sell their baby, you know, let us know."
Leon delivered the woman's baby, and he called that lawyer.
This really sad story where the girl had delivered out of wedlock, signed away the baby, and then the boy in her life came back. And she wanted to get the baby back, so she accused my grandfather of kidnapping the baby.
A big question for me in trying to understand Leon's murder charges was this. A woman showed up in his office and bled out on his table. He was accused of killing her while trying to perform an abortion, which he denies.
The baby might have been deceased 10 hours before the patient came in to see me. An abortion would have been impossible at the stage she was in. I did nothing to cause the bleeding. I hadn't even begun an internal examination.
He says he was just there to help with her onset of pain caused by fibroid tumors. He says he had been treating her for fibroids for 3 or 4 years, and she came to his office complaining of abdominal pains. If he hadn't given her an abortion, as he testified in his many trials, what exactly was he supposed to have done differently? Yael is a physician, so she has some perspective.
It happens that people bleed. Mm-hmm. It happens that no matter what you try, you can't stop the bleeding. But you have to at least try. And one person alone can't do everything.
Yeah.
So he would have needed help. He would have needed someone to call an ambulance. He would have needed extra help.
Her death was the greatest emergency of my life. I did everything I could to keep her alive.
At the time, Leon worked in a building on St. Catherine Street. And there were other doctors working there, too.
From what my mother described, he called for help. People came in and looked in, saw a woman bleeding, and walked away. And the other thing is, a woman died needlessly because all the colleagues wouldn't come to help him because they were so terrified of being associated with an abortion. Had there been other doctors and nurses coming in to help, they could have brought up her pressure. They could have stopped the bleeding.
Did the other doctors refuse to help because they thought Leon was conducting an abortion, which in those days was often seen as tantamount to murder? So Leon was left to try to save her himself. Blanche LaPierre died, and Leon Azoulay was charged with murder. Over a 10-year period, he faced 6 trials for abortion, murder, and for being part of the black market baby ring. One by one, the charges against him fell apart. On April 5th, 1957, a headline ran in the Gazette. Standing verdict. Dr. Azoulay free after 10 years. Then, 10 years after that headline, he was dead.
The last 10 years, he couldn't practice at all. He had developed a heart problem because of all the anxiety, you know. 10 years in front of the courts, I think he had 3 or 4 heart attacks over a 5-year period.
I want to tell you another story about a young man. His name was David. David Elkin. And the place where I'm going to start my story is the moment where David is 15,000 feet in the air and on the brink of disaster. Navigator David Elkin and his crew have already dropped their payload on the railway yards in Hanover, Germany. He's only 21 years old, but as navigator, it's his job to guide the crew back home. In the last 3 months, he's pulled it off 24 times, but this time is different. Your plane is hit. The engine bursts into flames. The pilot yells for everyone to bail. You clip on your parachute and open the hatch under your seat. Your crewmate is sitting on the floor crying. His parachute accidentally opened too soon. It sprawled out around him on the plane's floor. The smoke is thick. You jump. The plane explodes behind you. You fall through the dark night, Nazi Germany rushing up to meet you. You pull a letter from your pocket. It's from your grandmother, written in Yiddish. You tear it up. I found this story in a memoir my grandfather, David Elkin, wrote about his time in the Royal Canadian Air Force. Clearly, he survived that parachute drop into Germany, was a POW, and made it home to start a family. This is the first time I've named my grandfather in this episode. But he's been at the heart of this story. He was the first of 3 kids born to Sam and Jenny 100 years ago in Winnipeg, after they met Leon Azoulay. I shared this story with you because I didn't want my grandfather, David Elkin, to be a name that just passed by without drawing at least some sort of picture of the man. And so I chose this story in particular, of the narrow escape from the plane, because I first read it around the same time I learned of Leon and his connection to David and to me. Now we're nearing the end, and I confess I'm frustrated. I was close to my grandparents, David and my grandma Toby, but I never talked about this wild story with my grandfather, never asked him questions about Leon Azoulay. And I could have, because he did know him. Here's the last twist in my story. Leon stayed friends with the family. Sam and Jenny and his three biological children, at least until his legal troubles began. He went on to have three other kids with his own wife, Anna. You already met Harold, his only son. But I was never able to ask David, my grandpa, my Zadie, did you know? Did you know that family friend Leon was your actual father? Did you know how it all started? An affair or DIY artificial insemination? Did you know about the trials, the black market baby ring? I never asked these questions because I didn't know any of this until 2 years ago, until I started digging into the family secrets.
Eleven, 12, 13, if I counted right. This should be it.
It wasn't until I arrived in Montreal that I realized my grandparents and my great-grandparents are buried in the same cemetery as my biological great-grandfather, Leon Azoulay.
Yeah, Dr. Leon Azoulay, beloved husband, father, and grandfather. And he's buried right next to his wife, Anna Faye Azoulay. Wow. It's weird just seeing them here after so many years of researching them. I don't know, I feel just like I need to stand here for a second, kind of pay homage to Leon, because without him, I wouldn't be here, none of my family would be here. Oh my gosh, okay, yeah. So this is my grandparents' grave. Dr. David Elkin, beloved husband, father, grandfather, and brother, and Thelma Toby, or Toba Kugelmass Elkin, beloved wife, mother, grandmother, and sister. Ooh, yeah. Very weird to me that six people actually, if you include my great-grandparents too, who have all of these really complicated familial and blood ties are buried across the cemetery. And, you know, if I hadn't looked into who Leon was, I would have no idea that this connection even existed. So, we only have one rock, but I'm gonna put it in the center for both of them. Yeah, wasn't expecting to get a little emotional, but really miss my grandparents. Love you, Bubby. Love you, Zadie. See you later.
That is our show today. You can email me about what you heard. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. I'm also on Blue Sky. Go sign up for that and look me up there. Today's episode was reported by Alana Gordon and Adam Siegel. It was written by Alana Gordon, Adam Siegel, and Bruce Larson. Today's episode featured voice actors Daniel Strauss, Patrick DeNicola, and Jordan Cox. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Today's episode featured some original music by our own Tristan Capicchione, who is also the person who did the audio production and editing for today's episode. Production assistance is from Max Collins. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the news. We'll talk about the Liberal government's reversals on climate policy. We'll talk about Justin Trudeau's attempt to interest Canadians in some Hanukkah bush. I'm just reading from his J-Date profile here. But mostly, we will be talking about whether or not Trudeau just quietly ceded Canada's claim to the Arctic sovereignty. It's been kind of a slow burn issue in Canada for decades. Stephen Harper was obsessed with the Arctic ever since Canada's armed forces recovered his beloved childhood teddy bear from a glacier.
Franklin got lost. Many people couldn't find him, and you guys actually did it.
Wait for that. Welcome back to the show. Founder of The Pointer, doing local news coverage for Peel, Niagara, Brampton, San Greywall.
Thanks, Jesse.
Citing growing northern aggression from Russia and China, the federal government has unveiled a new Arctic foreign policy.
The Arctic is no longer a low-tension region.
The foreign policy commits Canada to increase north-to-north ties with the U.S. and Alaska and with Nordic nations like Norway, Sweden, and Finland.
Canada will create two new consulates in Alaska and Greenland, a new Arctic ambassador, and it will invest millions to deal with security threats posed by countries including Russia and China.
Interesting to note that when you look at the document, it actually talks about the North American Arctic.
The North American Arctic. It's like in there 13 times. The Trudeau government has finally unveiled their Arctic strategy, and there's this new term, the North American Arctic. Did you note that?
I did.
It's really interesting. I've just never heard that. Like, I remember back when Stephen Harper was PM, he got all excited about the North Pole. He had this like Boy Scout fervor. There was this very nationalistic, it was like multi-pronged, his approach to the pole. He saw this as like a point of Canadian patriotism.
Stephen Harper's love affair with the Arctic, and I can assure you from personal experience that his annual trips up there in the summer are the closest thing he ever gets to acting like a little kid, highlights the third Canadian foreign policy principle. Canadian foreign policy shall bolster patriotic pride.
It was also like bound up in recovering these Franklin shipwrecks.
Franklin got lost. Many people couldn't find him, and you guys actually did it. So congratulations, a big hand to everyone who was involved in that.
And Mansbridge came along on an adventure, and there was a little bit of controversy over using government resources for CBC reporting.
And I'd flown in by chopper to see them, spend a little time with them, and almost the moment I arrived, they had started finding a number of artifacts and a number of bones.
But there was also a natural resource part to this, because there's just like a ton, I think that's the technical term, a ton of natural and liquid gas in the Arctic. And then with global warming, the Northwest Passage is opening up. It's going to become really important. So he was positioning Canada in a bit of a tiff with the Americans over Arctic sovereignty.
From control over the Northwest Passage to mapping the Arctic Ocean floor, Canada is racing to stake its claim along with other polar countries. Scientists believe that 25% of the world's untapped oil and gas is in the Arctic. Harper's visit is a way to wave the flag.
There was no North American Arctic. There was Canada's Arctic.
But strangely, not supported by any
real funding that would have advanced Canadian sovereignty over the Arctic. So while exactly what you said, this Boy Scout fervor, you know, over the idea of protecting our North, but all of what the experts said during that period, right up until 2014, the year before he was not the prime minister anymore. He obviously ended his term in 2015, but right up until 2014, when he was being heavily criticized for failing to follow up those claims and the policies and all of this stuff, whether it was for natural resources or, as you said, for the shipping lanes or even, like, I don't know, I'll say it, lip service towards Indigenous communities, on and on and on. Where was the actual, come budget time, let's see your plan in motion. Let's see what sort of funding you're going to put toward, you know, this Canadian North, this Canadian Arctic. But it's not just Harper, right? Not that Trudeau has been as vociferous around this so-called Canadian Arctic, this patriotic kind of mission to claim the Arctic once and for all is like ours. But even Trudeau, what has he done to support any notion that territorial integrity, rights over natural resources, that future shipping lane use, you know, would be protected through anything that, you'd have to advance policy, and the policy would have to be supported by dollars. And in terms of the Americans, what I find interesting, go back to Obama, go back to the second Bush, and then certainly with Trump, look at the difference in the investments they've made in terms of in Alaska, what they've done in terms of military spending in that region. And maybe that's to counter Russia and China, I don't know. But the point is that it's a bunch of lip service from us and a bunch of action from them. And now we see this rollout of Jolly's new North American Arctic policy, like suddenly ditch the Canada, and all of a sudden it's the North American Arctic.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. You obviously feel a certain way about the Arctic. I don't have feelings about the Arctic yet. Maybe I will by the end of this conversation. I never felt any patriotic pride in claiming the Arctic.
And I'm from Manitoba.
Yeah, you got Churchill there. Okay, as you say, this goes back to, like, in 2007, Putin had a submarine put a Russian flag underwater. And if Canada wants to tussle with Putin, and then Denmark has a claim, and then America's looking at the shipping lanes, it's going to cost a lot of money. And the way in which countries jockey and kind of like posture over this is that there's icebreaker ships, and there's warplanes overhead, and there's submarines planting flags.
You've got ports that you need to invest in, and the infrastructure to support those shipping lanes. And even if the ports aren't going to be up there, you have to have these transitional infrastructure, even if those ships are getting down towards, you know, Vancouver or wherever, you know, the west or east coast of the United States, you still need a ton of infrastructure to start doing that stuff.
You need more than Mansbridge there reporting on a shipwreck.
But the big thing that you need, we do know that this Russia play for the Arctic that is now being underwritten by China, which we know, like we have all the information about the investments that they're making, because Russia started to get to the point where it just simply couldn't, as its economy was tanking, who comes in? China. And they've done this around the world, right? The way that they leverage their relationship over, whether it's Turkey or wherever it might be, is we're the ones that are going to build your infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It's all going to be Chinese companies that do it. So we know they've been doing that. But where's the Canadian response then?
So after this came out, after Canada released its Arctic foreign policy announcement, and this contained descriptions of Russian and Chinese threats to Arctic sovereignty, China has responded. As reported in The Globe, the Chinese embassy has issued a statement that Canada's, quote, so-called Arctic foreign policy distorts and misinterprets China's Arctic policy. And they say that China is just carrying out, quote, normal activities in accordance with international law. So what are we talking about here? What are these normal Arctic activities? China has been developing underwater listening devices that are developed specifically for the Arctic that can track stuff like submarines under the ice cap. There was the discovery of a Chinese monitoring buoy floating around Arctic waters. And this is my favorite one. You remember that high-altitude Chinese spy balloon that was flown over Alaska? The U.S. military shot this thing down. Biden called it that silly balloon. That silly balloon. That silly balloon that was carrying two freight cars worth of spying equipment. So that's what China, I guess, is calling normal law-abiding activity in the Arctic. But then, returning to the Canadian response and our shift to calling it the North American Arctic, even if Canada says that Russia and China are the reasons for this new policy, I think this actually has a lot more to do with the United States of America. I'm just looking at this through the media signals here. all of a sudden, we get this message about the North American Arctic, and I noticed that this came right on the heels of Trudeau's dinner with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And there was one little detail in that story that was not really focused on, but when reporting came out, and it was all whispers from like PMO sources as to what was discussed, trade, energy, and the Arctic were on the table at Mar-a-Lago. So that's interesting, you know, and that made me wonder about, like, what has Trump said about like, he's been opening up, unsurprisingly, in his first term, Alaska to drilling.
Well, it was already really open.
Yeah, but really taking the regulations off. So here's Trudeau meeting Trump in Florida, kissing the ring, and trying to counter this, like, potentially disastrous 25% tariff. And then the next thing you know, Canada is calling it North America's Arctic. And that makes me wonder, was this a bargaining chip? Was this a way of like, look, there's more to be gained for America by working together and essentially ceding the sovereignty, like the military resources needed to actually make this claim? America's just going to come and help a military spending laggard like Canada? No, they're getting cut in on the deal, one has to imagine, if that's what's happening. Here's what Melanie Joly said when this was being rolled out here.
Rising geopolitical competitions means that we need more eyes and ears in the North. We need to even have stronger ties with our Arctic allies, the United States and Nordic countries. The Arctic will be key in our engagement with the U.S. The U.S. is our closest partner and will continue to be as we invest in Arctic security with the new policy, the Arctic foreign policy, as its foundation.
So in practice, what Canada is actually committing to here is appointing an Arctic ambassador. Is that a plum posting, or is that what happens if you piss off Trudeau? I don't know. We will be opening a new consulate in Anchorage, Alaska, in Nuuk, Greenland. We will initiate an Arctic security dialogue with the ministers of foreign affairs and like-minded states in the Arctic. I wonder, like, the North America includes Mexico. Is this Mexico's Arctic? Is that part of this?
Yeah, and to your point, Jesse, about, you know, the bargaining chip. And this is where I think you're right. I think there's an element of that. But I think most of this is the reality that if there's a legitimate concern, and there should be, that there's this rising threat from China and Russia who want access not just to the natural resources, but as you said, the shipping lanes. How on earth, in terms of fending off, you know, threats to our territorial integrity, is Canada with our military? Like, it's not just that we don't spend the 2% on NATO. It's what all those NATO reports show, that we don't have military equipment that could even do the things that you would need to do to defend the Arctic. We don't have other military resources, but who has it? The states. And even if we bump up our spending to 2% on NATO, mm-hmm. or just even domestically, we take a look at like what we need to have infrastructure wise for the military up there to do these things that suddenly Joly and Trudeau want to do. There's no way we'd be in a position for another 15, 20 years. Like, there's reports out there that have said, like, we are not going to be prepared in terms of the resources you would need to do these things, even though this has just come out, this new policy. But we know from previous reporting on our military spending and our military capabilities that we are 15, 20 years just from just being caught up to where we should have been. So
we might as well trade it away.
Well, no, but I think it's a matter of the only way we're going to be able to legitimately ward off the Russians and the Chinese is if, as usual, we get our cousins south of the border, you know, the big bad Americans, to come in and plant their flag, you know, all across the Arctic and bring their military and bring their submarines and bring their icebreakers and everything else. And we want to be a part of that with the new, quote, North American Arctic.
Here's a ratio for you. In June 2022, Trudeau announced that Canada would be putting money into this. Our NORAD modernization plan would be backed by an investment of $38.6 billion. Of that commitment, here's what's been spent so far. $70 million. $70 million. So I have to look at this as a little bit of horse trading in order to placate the Americans.
But I also think desperation that we need the Americans.
All right, after the break, we're going to take a closer look at Melanie Joly, what she has said about Canada's plan for dealing with Trump. Wait for that. Here is what Melanie Joly said in a follow-up interview on CTV's Question Period with Vashi Kapelos.
The president will be inaugurated on January 20th. I know that there's lots of concerns across the country, but at the same time, we're doing the work. We had a plan from the get-go because we've been working on different scenarios. We're now implementing that plan. And the plan was to create this U.S.-Canada committee, was to engage rapidly by going to Mar-a-Lago.
So that seemed to confirm to me my suspicion that this was something that got woven in to whatever Trudeau needed to accomplish in that dinner at Mar-a-Lago. San, you kind of get the idea that like Trump could get a date with Trudeau's mother right now if he wanted it. Like Trudeau is just making all these concessions before the bargaining even begins. So, you know, in addition to it now being the North American Arctic, we also read from the CBC on Wednesday that Trudeau got together with Team Canada, got together with all of the premiers, and they started to put a plan in place to tighten up the borders. And as the CBC reports, they are going to be putting further restrictions on the chemical precursors that are used to make fentanyl. They'll be improving coordination between the RCMP and other police forces. So, you know, it lends a lot of credibility. Like, yeah, our border is a problem and we'll get on it right away, sir. Said not even at the bargaining table over this looming tariff trade war thing yet, and already Trudeau is making these concessions, and I think that maybe declaring it North America's Arctic is part of the pre-bargaining concession.
Yeah, and I think also it what you said before in terms of Alaska and the oil and gas resources, it's been opened for a long time, but what Trump has outlined, he did this in his first administration, and we know some of his plan for the second administration is to put that on, you know, hyperspeed. You know, the opening up of all sorts of oil and natural gas and liquid natural gas resources up in that part of the world.
They think it could be bigger than Saudi Arabia in Alaska, could be bigger than Saudi Arabia. But they went in and they terminated it. And I'll get it going very quickly because not only is it big for Alaska, I mean, you talk about economic development, that for the United States, I mean, that is, they say bigger than Saudi Arabia or the same size. And pure, really good stuff.
And Canada is going to have to be a part of that, right? Like Canada, the reality is that whether it's through our pipeline infrastructure or our refinery and our other downfield like oil sector infrastructure, whether it's through other connections and a lot of what is going on, what you just talked about, they're sitting there in Mar-a-Lago and they come and kiss the ring and say, yeah, you know what? If you need to hear from us that we're going to be a liberal administration, if we somehow, you know, win the next election.
Well, this whole thing is a hypothetical fantasy conversation.
And that's why I find it kind of comical. The Arctic thing, the meeting with Trump, like we're talking about an election that they have no chance of winning. They're not going to be in government. They won't be part of a minority. They're going to be devastated. They're going to be barely hanging on to official party status. So the conversation,
it's a magical fantasy conversation that I think Trump is only having to toy and mock.
No, but it's a clear message to Poilievre and the conservatives that we're not going to be having any diplomacy around this. We're not going to be sitting down for negotiations. We're going to tell you what we're going to do and you're going to do it.
I think in the waning days of any Canadian federal government, we see the lie. And in the waning days of the Harper government, we saw the desperation with the Barbaric Cultural Practices Hotline. It sort of like laid bare what they really are. And in the waning days of Trudeau, like, what does this have to do with his climate change commitments and promises? What does this have to, like, it's...
We're going to get into that later on one of the duly noted segments, but I mean, don't even get me started about the liberal climate change policies.
I want to move on in a minute, but before we do, San, I just want to ask you, because you worked at the Toronto Star for a long time, as the action moves increasingly to the north, as expensive as it is and out of our government's reach to sufficiently invest in the north, is it within the Canadian media's reach to cover the north? Like, where are we going to get the reporting on this?
The capacity of the Canadian media to do this sort of thing, it's been dwindling, you know, day by day.
We used to have it. I remember talking to Paul Watson when he was...
Yeah, I was talking to your producer when we were setting up the show about the great work that Paul did, like the huge project the Star undertook, the late John Hondrick. It was a huge personal issue for him. He did a couple of the big pieces about the North himself, front page Toronto Star pieces when John Hondrick flew up in a little single prop Cessna, you know, heading off to do a big piece on the need to protect it. It was mostly environmental coverage, but there were some other elements about, you know, territorial sovereignty and integrity in the Arctic and some other elements of it.
Tons of articles about this.
Yeah, but no, I mean, give me a break, whether it's the CBC, the Globe, the Star, the other outlets that we would expect that kind of, but you know who is going to do that coverage? You know who is going to dominate the narrative? You know who is going to spin and dictate what Canadians consume? The American media.
Talk about a news desert. This is the Canadian news tundra. San, what do you have to duly note today?
More than 100 Canadian scientists penned a letter to Canadian Environmental Minister Stephen Gibeault, and they basically said, what are you doing with the 413 highway in Ontario? They said, this is ridiculous. You need to use your own legislation, the Impact Assessment Act, to review this highway and take a look at the very least, force a proper environmental assessment, get Indigenous consultation done, take a look at endangered species, like all the habitat that's going to be destroyed, make sure you do your job. And it's just a trend with Gibeault. Like, whether it was Bay du Nord approving that deal, now it's on about a three-year hiatus. But, you know, that was for like more than a billion barrels of oil. I don't know if anyone's followed it, but, you know, Gibeault just rubber stamped one of the largest thermal coal expansions in Alberta just in the last week. Tons of thermal coal that will be produced by this new operation. It's an existing mine. But we keep talking about the carbon tax, and the Liberals want to like hang their hat on that, and I support the carbon tax. But when is Gibeault going to actually stop the projects that produce the carbon that you want to tax?
Duly noted. Sen, I want to duly note something that came to my attention via the Canadian Jewish News. They were looking at this incredibly complicated list of category exemptions for Justin Trudeau's GST holiday. What can a person buy effective December 14th without GST, HST, for this gift, this holiday gift from Justin Trudeau? When the announcement first came out, I thought, oh, this feels like a little bit culturally skewed here, that like Christmas trees, you can go and get Christmas trees and not pay GST. And it seemed like a little bit tone deaf to exclude other people. Well, this inclusive prime minister of ours seems to have read my mind, because it's not just Christmas trees. No, the list includes Hanukkah bushes. What the f*** is a Hanukkah bush? I've never seen a Hanukkah bush in my life. A Hanukkah bush? I was feeling very put out by this. And then I went and looked it up. And sure enough, there's a Wikipedia page. Some Jews have Hanukkah bushes. And I'm not the kind of Jew who says this is too much of an assimilated Christmas wannabe. Do whatever you want to do. There's no Hanukkah on this list. Like, you can't buy these things in Judaica stores. There's no Hanukkah bush. I don't know about you. We are both members of ethnic minorities. I just love being pandered to. How do you feel about it?
Oh, I can't wait to see what Revenue Canada and the federal government's going to do when about 2 million Indo-Canadians retroactively submit receipts for all their Diwali candles and Diwali celebrations and the various items that they all bought. And they're thinking, why wasn't this bill passed, you know, when we were celebrating our holiday?
What you got to do is, it's not on the list, a Diwali candle. You got to call it a Hindu ornament. An ornament, and then there'll be a check mark beside it.
Duly noted.
That is our show for today. San, thank you for joining me. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send, and I'm on Blue Sky now. I'm posting there fairly regularly, so come join at Blue Sky and look me up. San, where can people find you?
You can reach me at info@thepointer.com.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson, mixing and mastering by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins. Lucy Lemonnier did the fact check on this episode. I'm the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a song from local artist Kakao's third album, Quantum Entanglement, released on November 29th. Quantum Entanglement is inspired by the cosmic placement of the soul in the universe, connected as one with a newly sober mind fueling the creation process. The album channels the focus of intent and inspiration of spirituality in raising the vibrational state of self and awareness in the connection of souls with quantum entanglement theories. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Quantum Entanglement on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it entitled Affinity here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.